Welcome again. This is session 13, and we move now from the world of conflict and post-conflict situations to the world of international peaceful interactions and the field of international political economy. Today's such session is on trade and protectionism, and it also involves the World Trade Organization. And I will start out first here by explaining the basic principle of free trade and why free trade is beneficial for the society. I will tell something about how history of world trade has evolved over decades and centuries. And in the latter parts of this session, I will talk about the World Trade Organization and the winners and losers of trade, which is closely linked to the issue of protectionism. The idea of free trade came up with in the area of enlightenment. So what kind of commercial policy of trade policies did states pursue at this point of time? Especially in France, it was the doctrine of mercantilism. So meaning that states would try to raise levy tariffs and this income could then be used for specific purposes, especially for the luxury goods that the crown used, but also to finance wars and other state activities. But analysis have found that this was a very inefficient system. These states faced quite heavy economic crisis, and especially in France, this contributed then to the revolutionary tendencies. Colbert, who was one of the inventors of the system of mercantilism, described then this system of based on tariffs and taxes as the art of taxation consists in so plucking the goose as to procure the largest quantity of feathers with the least possible amount of hissing. But obviously the goose can escape this process partly and simply produce less and to avoid taxation through other means. This system proved to be ineffective, and then political economists in Scotland in the 18th and in the 19th centuries advocated free trade as an alternative. And on this I will focus now. So the first philosopher here that plays a role was Adam Smith, who stated in his influential volume on the Wealth of Nations, "If a foreign country can supply us with a commodity cheaper than we ourselves can make it, better buy it of them with some part of the produce of our own industry, employed in a way in which we have some advantage." The key term advantage plays a big role. And another political economist of the next generation, David Ricardo, invented then the system of comparative advantage. And important here is that it's not the absolute advantage that a country has matters, but the comparative advantage in comparing the production of a specific good. And what he states here is that following these unilateral incentives, the individual advantage is welfare enhancing. Free trade is beneficial for the entire society. And this leads then to specialization in the production of certain goods. This is the typical example here. So today one would exchange these two goods here, but the two country situation comparison between England and Portugal. England has to pay more for its laborers So both the costs in producing cloth, but also in producing wine are larger than for Portugal. But if you then look at the opportunity costs by analyzing how much, for instance, the production on one bolt of cloth costs in terms of a barrel of wine for England and Portugal, then you see here that it is here the comparative advantage and not the absolute advantage that matters, that England has a comparative advantage in the production of cloth, while Portugal has an advantage, a comparative advantage in the production of the wine. So the economists should then specialize in that, and they should engage into exporting the goods in which they have a comparative advantage. And the other country should import this particular good. To start out the welfare analysis, one can start out in a situation of autarky. And in a situation of autarky, you have just to consider the demand and the supply of the good, which is expressed here as quantity Q. Quantity Q is where the supply and the demand curve meet. In such a situation, because you have a reduction in the price because of an increasing demand, this also means that you have a consumer surplus, and then you also have a producer surplus in this situation. And these two triangles are important to consider the societal benefits from moving to a situation of free trade. In a situation of free trade, the prices of the goods are reduced, meaning that the consumer surplus increases while the producer surplus decreases in its size. And what you see here also is that a larger quantity can be consumed, obviously at lower prices. So you produce a certain quantity through your home industry, and the rest is then imported. And this you see here in the quantity from QD to QS. This is imported. So you have domestic suppliers and international suppliers to consider. The same can be analyzed when you look at a figure with the concepts that I already introduced before in this class, the production possibility curve. So when you have then an autarkic country, then you have to consider for the two goods simply the price line, which is here the price line S1, where this price line is tangential to the production possibility curve. You have the equilibrium in the production of the two goods. If now you open up your economy for free trade, what you see here is a shift in the price line, and you have a shift towards the international price line. And what you need then to consider is then where this international price line is tangential to the production possibility curve, but also tangential to this ESO utility curves. So you get then two points to consider, U and H, in this situation here. And this expresses then what quantities here will be imported of the good G3 minus G1, and what quantities will be exported, D3 minus D1, of the good D, where this particular country has an advantage. Free trade is beneficial. It creates a consumer surplus. This is also important to consider when you think about trade wars and tariffs. A tariff puts a price on a specific good, and what it reduced through that is the consumer surplus. When you think about the terms about the guy currently residing in the White House, that trade wars are winnable. Trade wars are by definition not winnable, because every trade war will reduce the consumer surplus, and the bill for a trade war is paid by the domestic population. And it also obviously increases then the price firms have to pay for goods that they need to import for the production of goods for the domestic market. What we observe when we look at world trade and how it has evolved over times are different periods of openness and closure, or to put it differently, periods of globalization periods of protectionism. So up to the mid 1800s, there was a situation of protectionism, and then through unilateral policy changes in the United Kingdom, a first period of globalization began. So this was the abolishment of the Corn Law, tariffs after famine in Ireland, and other ills that a protectionist policy produced in the United Kingdom. We had then a first period of globalization up to the beginning of World War I. Trade historians are a little bit controversial about this point. Some believe that the first period of globalization ended earlier, but you can still say that World War I ended this first globalization period. In the interwar years, then was a period of protectionism, of trade wars, and then after World War II, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs was built, a multilateral institution that tried to resolve trade disputes in the long term. Now we are obviously in a situation where protectionism is much more en vogue than it used to be only 10 years ago. There are different studies about the benefits of free trade. Here I just take one example, a simulation run by Richard Baldwin from the Graduate Institute in Geneva. So he looked at what the effects are of the 1992 program of the European Union. With the 1992 program, the single market, the internal market, was created. It was already there in the Treaty of Rome, but it took several decades until a truly internal market was established in the European Union. And according to these simulations, these effects are quite large. Obviously, when you move towards autarky, as Great Britain does through its grandiose Brexit strategy. At the time that I say this, we do not really yet know whether there is a soft Brexit or a softer Brexit or a hard Brexit. There are considerable costs for that. And here is a rather conservative estimations, some estimations for the GDP, long-term reduction in the British GDP go up to 10% for a hard Brexit, where you have to distinguish between the trade effects and the fiscal benefits of no longer paying that much money to the European Union. And you can say, as the British Prime Minister, these are peanuts and we will be a happy nation then afterwards. But obviously such a reduction in GDP will have quite tremendous effect on the British society. There will also be, and already was, considerable depreciation of the British pound, and such a depreciation is especially hurtful for poorer parts of the British society. So there will be massive distributional effects in Great Britain due to this anti-free trade policy. What other factors do we see? We see that international trade has grown more quickly than GDP. International trade is also no longer the same than it used to be, for instance, in the 19th century. So what we have here in recent decades is then a development that has been called intra-industry trade. So there is, for instance, within certain industry trade that goes from Germany to France or the other way around. So certain products are assembled. Think about airplanes, Airbus airplanes, and so on over different parts of the continent. This is again reducing then costs, and this has contributed to what we observe here or have observed under the headings of globalization. But it's also important that not all industries are touched by these developments to the same extent, and you can see then changes in the relative exposure to trade over decades. So here just some information about different industries in the United States. So you see here, for instance, that the food and beverages industry has been much more globalized in the interwar years than it is today. But an opposite development happened for capital goods and also for automobile industries, which is now a much more global industry than when this industry started in the 1910s and 1920s. What you see here is just how the system has evolved over time. I mentioned the corn laws, then the new protectionism. This is stuff that I have already said. The World Trade Organization was based on the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. The World Trade Organization came into being after the conclusion of the Uruguay round. And what we see now and still observe is opposition against this multilateral free trading world. Over the decades, and this does not yet include what has happened since the presidential elections of 2016, is just a general reduction in tariff rates. But you also see here the trade wars after the Great Depression, so the imposition of the smooth haulage tariff This was a bilateral system. So each state decided about its tariff rates alone. And when then one state increased its tariffs, this was triggering off similar tariff races, arms races to a certain extent in other states. So the World Trade Organization, the GATT, the general idea was here to reduce simply the danger of unilateral trade policies. And to this topic, I will then return after the mini break. So just please think about who are the people who are most hurt by trade wars, and why can trade wars not be won ultimately? And here, a major opponent of the Trumpian policies is a Nobel Prize winner, Paul Krugman. Welcome again about this in this session about trade and the organization of trade. As I've said in the first part of this session, we are now in a period which is much more unilateral than the situation about 10 years ago. And this is obviously due to politicians or showmasters like Donald Trump, who do not really understand the basics of trade. Here's just a nice, or some nice verbatim quotes by him in an interview by the British Economist. So when you look at these kind of documents, you see that the current president of the United States has no clue about the principles of trade and about the benefits of a multilateral organization of trade. As I've mentioned beforehand, the World Trade Organization started out as the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. And it was simply only a treaty in the beginning, because after World War II, the United States Senate refused to ratify the treaty setting up the International Trade Organization. Since the 1990s, through the conclusion of the so-called Uruguay Round, we have now the World Trade Organization. And the World Trade Organization still obviously includes the general agreements on tariffs and trade, but it also tries to regulate trade in other domains, like services and so on. So you see here the structure of the World Trade Organization, which is part of the UN scheme of organizations. So it means that it's an organization with a global aspiration. What you have through the Uruguay Round is the GATT and the GATS, but then also what is called TRIPS. So it tries to regulate intellectual property. Another innovation of the Uruguay Round was a dispute settlement mechanism. So if there is a trade dispute between two parties, then a panel of judges at the World Trade Organization can try to come up with a supranational ruling to which the member states, the disputants, have to adhere. The policies by the different member states are then also reviewed. And so this creates a certain transparency. These are the so-called trade policy reviews. World Trade Organization is a multilateral organization, and one has chosen this multilateral framework after World War II just to prevent the bilateral trade disputes, which then can create, trigger trade wars, and obviously lead then to an escalation in tariff rates across the worlds, which then will reduce welfare, create unemployment around the world, and so on. These multilateral principles are expressed then through two basic principles. One of them is the principle of non-discrimination, of no discrimination, and this is expressed through the most favored nation clause. And this simply means that if there is a regional agreement between two sides, so for instance between Morocco and the European Union, then all concessions that that the European Union grants to Morocco have also to be granted to all other member states of the organization. The second principle is the principle of gradualism, and it means that the World Trade Organization tries to proceed then through the multilateral negotiations. It has been quite successful with that policy of gradualism up to the 1990s. So here you see that the organization is really a multilateral organization, and that there are very few states which are not members of this particular organization. Some states, especially in the Maghreb and in sub-Saharan Africa, are in a negotiation currently the accession to the organization, and only countries, for instance, like North Korea and Greenland are not part of this multilateral framework, which does not work very well at the moment because, as you might know, the Trump administration tries to block here new appointments to the supranational bodies which try to regulate conflict. So this has become dysfunctional. So the European Union, as one of the influential members of the organization, tries to prevent this through some policy accommodations. I've talked about the principle of gradualism, and gradualism is expressed through the negotiations. And you see here the different rounds that have been successfully concluded. In the beginning, these negotiation rounds took place in Geneva or in neighboring French cities like Annecy. These rounds were named after the places where the first or the last negotiations took place. So, for instance, the Tokyo round or the Uruguay round. What you see here is that the scope of the cooperation has been enlarged over time. So in the beginning, there was just an attempt to regulate tariffs, and nowadays it's also other aspects of international trade. The Doha round is going on since a long time, but it has not yet been concluded, and perhaps this will be the first negotiation round that will not be successful, and then some new negotiations might start in due course. What is particularly disputed between the states is the role of agricultural tariffs. You have here then the developing countries which are in opposition then to the industrialized world, especially also the European Union. The European Union, not its member states, are here the negotiation parties, because the European Union, or rather the European Commission, has the negotiation power in this domain since the 1990s. What are the effects of the GATT and the World Trade Organization? There are some econometric studies which try to evaluate whether this movement towards free trade over multilateral organization has had really beneficial impact on trade, whether it has increased trade and through that also increased global welfare. The first study by Andy Rose was rather skeptic. He believed, as you see here in the table, that this impact has been reduced over time, that you find then for the Uruguayan and also preceding negotiation rounds, also negative impacts. Other studies claim that this study is based on not so proper research design. And another study by Subramanian and Wei then says that the overall effect is positive, but it depends on what kind of industry you are looking at. And so you see here that there are also then negative impacts of this for specific industries where certain countries, like for instance, the industrial countries, when you look at the footwear industries, where they do not have a comparative advantage, that here the impact has been a negative one. But overall, the effect is positive, so multilateral trade is at the aggregate really welfare improving, although for certain parts of societies there are distributional effects. So import competing industries obviously will lose in such a situation, but the consumer rents are positive. The World Trade Organization is not a perfectly functioning system. What you also have are exemptions to this multilateral framework, and especially two of them are important. And I would like to mention first anti-dumping measures. What is anti-dumping? So this is an unfair trade practice where a certain good is sold on an international market under the price, with a lower price than the market price. And certain countries engage into this practice, so for instance with regard to solar panels, in order to destroy the industry, the competing industry in another country. And so this is anti-dumping. And some of these measures that are then implemented by member states of the World Trade Organization are justified, because there is really then unfair trade practices by a certain trade partner, but not always. It can also be protectionist measures. The second aspect here are preferential trade agreements. When you have regional agreements, the European Union is the most important one, you have always two aspects. So on the one hand, you create trade, and on the other side, you divert trade. This is the destruction of trade, and this is the creation of trade through a regional agreement. So think about, again, about the free trade agreement between Morocco and the European Union with regard to specific agricultural products. The agreement will intensify the trade between Morocco and the European Union member states. So this is the welfare enhancing aspect of such a regional agreement. Simultaneously, other competitors, for instance, from Algeria or other Maghreb states, will then be discriminated because they have higher difficulties, or they have more enhanced difficulties in entering these markets, and then trade is diverted or destroyed with this potential third state. And here it matters whether the trade diversion is larger than the trade creation when you look at the overall impact of regional agreements. Most studies believe that, for instance, with regard to the European Union, trade creation has been larger than trade destruction. But the World Trade Organization knows about these difficulties, and this also means that all these preferential trading agreements have to be notified to the World Trade Organization Secretariat, which keeps track. There are many regional trade agreements. There has been an increase over recent decades, but not all of these trade agreements are then really functioning. So here you see a map, and some of these trade agreements have then protectionist effects, meaning that trade destruction, trade diversion is larger than trade creation. And this is, for instance, the case, at least some econometric studies have shown this for the Mercosur agreements, where it is, for instance, much harder nowadays than for certain European producers to enter these particular markets. Think about the German automotive sector. I will now move to the last part of session 13, which is about the winners and losers of trade. And then I will also say something about protectionism, the logic of protectionism. As I have said beforehand, when you open up an economy, this is beneficial for the overall society, but obviously certain parts of the society will lose because these producers are then not efficient. They do not have a comparative advantage. And to understand this, two major models have been proposed, and these models look at different cleavages within a society. And the first one that I want to present here is the Ricardo-Weiner model, and it assumes that the cleavage, the conflict line in society, is between different industries, meaning the export industry versus the import competing industries. If you now open up the economy, you lower tariffs, move towards the international price, then the import competing industry will have to adapt. The assumption of this model is here that the factors are immobile between the industries, at least in the short run, meaning that a worker in the imported competing industry, where certain plants are closed because of this adaptation of the trade policy of a certain state, that this worker cannot immediately flock then to the export industry. So the cleavage here is between the export sector and the import competing industry. The second general model is the Heckscher-Ohlin model, which is very similar to the Stolper-Samuelson model, to the extent that they look at the cleavage between the factors of production, capital and labor, and to a certain extent then also land. And what matters here is then, when you look at the Heckscher-Ohlin model, is that you look at better which factor is abundant in an economy. In the industrialized countries, the factor that is abundant is capital. In the developing world, it is labor. And this means that you would have trade preferences depending on whether you, as a factor owner, have more pronounced capital interests or more pronounced labor interests. Abundant factor should be in favor of free trade. So capital-intensive industries here should be major proponents of the Doha round, of further openings of the economy. And in the developing world, it should be the opposite. It should rather be labor. But an additional hypothesis that you can derive from this particular model is a hypothesis that refers to the skills or the education. So people with higher skills can be more mobile and move from one state to another state because their skills are demanded on the labor market. And obviously then these people are in favor of free trade because they can earn then potentially higher wages in another country, or when the economy becomes more competitive because of increased international trade. When you look now at the empirical evidence for these models, and you want to engage into a horse race, whether the Heckscher-Ohlin or the Ricardo-Weiner model is more influential, then you cannot come up with a clear conclusion. So empirically, you find support for both the cleavage between industry and the cleavage between factors of production. So take here the Beaulieu study of Canadian free trade agreement and who was supporting that. So he shows that both industry effects were important. It was also important how educated, how skillful respondents were, what kind of industry they were with regard to whether or not this was rather capital intensive or not. So both hypotheses have some empirical support. Okay, when you look at preferences of people, you also see here that skill levels are quite important. Here is a macro study, and this is panel B. So you see here that the, whether or not people at the average have pro-trade attitudes, and this is highly dependent on the level of education in this country. And you see here that, for instance, in West Germany, here this free trade orientation is quite large and quite pronounced. Again, opposite evidence when you look then at a counter movement towards free trade, like the Brexit vote, then you see here that the probability that someone voted for leave, meaning for Brexit, decreases with the more the better educated they are. So skillful people have an interest in the lowering of tariffs and so on. This is completely in line with the Heckscher-Ohlin model. The second aspect that I want to discuss here are just protectionism. So although countries, governments have an interest to move towards free trade because of the beneficial impact that it does have, they might then use protectionist instruments. And this can be explained then through the political process, to which I will come in a minute. They can do so classically through tariffs, through import quotas, something that has been used, for instance, in the automobile sector, that only a certain amount of countries were allowed to be of cars from a specific country were allowed to be imported in comparison to the national production. You can also engage into protectionism in more subtle ways. And you can use, for instance, health regulations in order to come up with protectionist policies. So in the 1970s, a regional court in Germany ruled that Cassis de Dijon should not be sold in Germany. This is a liquor produced in France for health reasons, and the nice argument was that it was not sufficiently alcoholic. This regional ruling was overturned by the European Court of Justice, which said, okay, we had the Treaty of Rome, and the Treaty of Rome stipulated the creation of an internal market. But this example just shows that you can use other legislative means than simply tariffs in order to come up with protectionist policy. Anti-dumping legislation can also be used as a substitute and different forms of subsidies. So when you, for instance, subsidize Lufthansa or other airline companies, you can manipulate the exchange rate to lower the value of the dollar to make your export industry more competitive, or do the same with the euro. German manufacturing has profited for a long time from the introduction of the euro because it made German exports simply much cheaper comparatively. So these are all means of protectionism. So the question then is, how can we explain protectionism? Obviously, there is a political process, and you can explain this that through the lenses of the Heckscher-Ohlin model, of the Ricardo-Weiner model, and you have seen some evidence for that. If always assuming that certain factors or certain industries have a specifically good influence on the political process, and you can use collective action theory or similar theoretical strands in order to do so. Then there is also something rather trivial. So states differ in their size. Larger states have a larger internal market, meaning that they do not have to be that much concerned about free trade than smaller states, which heavily depend obviously on the exportation for the success of their economies. It matters how large the influence of special interest is. In industrialized countries, you have a disproportional influence, for instance, of the agricultural industries. So this is part of a distributional coalition. When you use the terms of Menker Olsen's, then certain parts of the citizenry are quite important. So certain groups are especially at risk to lose their jobs through offshoring or through automation. So this also plays a role. And then in the end, it also matters what kind of political institutions you have. I will go through some of these factors. First year study by Stephanie Walter from the University of Zurich, who was a student here at the University of Constance. What she does is that she uses refinements of the models of trade that I have just introduced. So she goes and looks then also at specific firms and looks at whether certain firms and sectors are particularly at risk. And she finds then support for this. Then it depends on whether here, and then this you see in the last model, the conditional model, a general divergence between high-skilled and low-skilled, but this matters then, this is interacted by the industry in which they are. You see here what the preferences here are. In a non-tradable sector, you see here that the labor market risk perceptions are not that large as in a tradable sector, and that you have there a clear divide between low-skilled and high-skilled. That's typical Heckscher and Olin. And you then also see that the distribution matter on whether or not the sector is here tradable or not. And so people who are in a sector where they risk then that they lose their jobs as a consequence of globalization, offshoring, automation, they want to have then here this risk compensated through state intervention, and they hope then, or have a more pronounced hope for redistribution. This is also influenced by politics, and it also influences then certain political competitions. So here is a study on how here the specific structure of the industry in the US has influenced then the probability that the Republican presidential candidate is elected. And here the study by Margolid is done in a comparison for the vote between 2000 and 2004. So this was the first and the second election that brought George W. Bush into the White House. And you see here that where the outsourcing is particularly pronounced, that the offshore outsourcing is particularly pronounced, that the Republican incumbent was particularly losing ground. Another study also gives evidence for that across different democracies. So Owen and Johnston find then that here the offshore ability, whether a job is a particular risk to move to another country, meaning that a respondent in this survey can become unemployed, influences then protectionist tendencies. Again, trade preferences and similar results then can be found for automation, where the risk is particularly high that a certain job is then taken up by a robot. Such developments also influence, do not only influence politics in the United States, but also influence politics in Germany. So there is, for instance, a study which tries to show that support for the right-wing NPD is particularly large in counties which have lost exports to Eastern Europe and China. And so you see here, for instance, a particularly pronounced tendency for that in Franconia and obviously the part of the new Länder. These economic factors influence then politics and policy making across the world. The last thing that I want to do is just to show that electoral institutions might have an influence on the level of protectionism. One study by Mansfield and Bush claimed that proportional level increases non-tariff barriers to trade. So these are all these indirect measures states take. Their argument is members of parliament that have been elected in a proportional representation system, they are not that accountable to their voters. they are in return much more prone to be influenced by special interests, agricultural interests, and so on, and give them more into protectionist interests. They find support for this in the estimation here, but other studies have contested that and come up with opposite findings here. So, for instance, a study here by Stephanie Reichert, published 10 years ago, where she looked at the behavior within the World Trade Organization complaints, and she found that majoritarian system, meaning non-proportional systems, have this effect. She also looks at district magnitude. The larger a voting district is, the more proportional it is, and she finds similar evidence. So we do not have yet a general theory here on how electoral institutions affect the level of protectionism across countries, but we have some findings for both that the losers of trade, of globalization, have specific political preferences, and that it matters in which firm you are, in which factors you work, how much education you have, to explain how protectionist your attitudes are. And then in enlargement of this, how politicians, depending on these voters, will behave in democracies. So this is my last pre-recorded session. Thomas Malang will now take over. Thank you for listening to these different sessions.